Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we welcome Elliot Easton from the Empty Hearts. Elliot was an original founding member of the Cars and has sold over 30 million records and scored films, and was part of the soundtrack for directors such as Quentin Tarantino. The Empty Hearts' debut self-titled album is available now on iTunes and Amazon. Flow Guitar Enthusiast is proudly sponsored by Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio at www.sweetwater.com. And now here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. We have a great show for you tonight. We're really excited about this. Scott, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I've been busy taking quite a few pictures of different gear that I have to post up on Instagram for just some little bit of gear porn or guitar porn, as you like, you know, for whatever. But, you know, as long as there's no nudity involved on my guitars, then
they are naked guitars, though.
Well, then Instagram's going to probably kick me off.
That's so. Right. No, but they are great shots of the
guitars. Yeah, so definitely check those out. They're on my Instagram's site for Selenium, and then you can also check out my YouTube channel, which is at Selenium. So all kinds of fun stuff there. What have you been up to, Jeff?
Everything's come in now, so I got the LR Bags pickups, and I have my friend's Gibson J45, and I have my Martin, and I'm just getting it all set up for Monique to take and put the pickups in, and then we should have them amplified, so it'll be interesting. I have the Anthem system with the microphone and the transducer.
Cool.
So it'll be interesting, and it'll be a good demo. We're going to have this on the show, and I talked to Kenny Burgle, and we're going to try to get Lawrence Bags on, the guy that designed the pickup on. And then what we're going to do on the show is we're going to mic it live and also have the pickup system in so you can hear the difference. So it should be a really cool show. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that'll be really cool. Well, why don't we take a quick break, and then we'll bring on Mr. Elliot Easton.
Sounds like a plan. Here we go.
Hi, this is Aaron Raby, your resident guitars and amps geek at Sweetwater Sound. 1-800-222-4700 or catch us on the web at www.sweetwater.com. Sweetwater is proud to partner with The Flow in bringing you the latest and greatest in all guitar-related things, be it tone, be it artists and musicians, their secrets on their tone, amplification, and live performance. We at Sweetwater are just as passionate as the folks on The Flow in bringing you what we consider to be the best in pro audio equipment and guitar and PA gear. Give us a call and we'll discuss gear whenever you like. The number here is 800-222-4700. And again, you can catch us on the web at www.sweetwater.com. I'm Aaron Raby, and thanks again for listening.
All right, everyone, you are listening to Jeff and Scott on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, and I'm Paul Reed Smith from PRS Guitars, and that's kind of what's going on. Enjoy the show.
We'll be right back.
Well, once again, I want to welcome our guest, Elliot Easton, from The Empty Hearts. It is an honor to have you on. Welcome, Elliot.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. Glad to be here.
I appreciate it. Well, first, can you just tell us the story of kind of how The Empty Hearts even came about?
Sure, I can tell you that. It basically originated with a phone call that I received from Andy Babiuk, our bass player. Now, for those of your listeners who don't know who Andy Babiuk is, he is the was the bass player for a great garage band called Chesterfield Kings. And he's very famous for writing the books on Beatles gear and Stones gear, and also a book about Bigsby. And anyway, Andy and I have been friends for about 25 years, and he called me one day and he said, what would you think about having a band with me and you and Clem from Blondie and Wally from the Romantics? And I said, that sounds great. You know, I mean, the joke of the whole thing is I didn't really think it was going to ever happen. So I just said yes, because I figured, what have I got to lose? Because I didn't think it was going to happen, you know. But I made my first big mistake with underestimating Andy Babiuk and his ability to get things done. And he actually pulled it off. And everybody agreed to try the band. And so Wally Palmer flew out to Rochester, where Andy lives, and they started writing songs together. And then they came to Los Angeles to meet with Clem and I. And we finished off those songs and polished them off and brought some new ideas for new song ideas, and we worked on those. And that happened a couple of times where those guys came out to L.A. and we went into a rehearsal room. And after a few times of getting together, we had enough songs for an album. So the thing to do after that was we all converged on Rochester, New York, to Andy's studio, where he's recorded all the Chesterfield Kings records, and we made the album. And the album was basically tracked in 5 days, and then some overdubs, and then we brought in Ian McLaughlin from the Faces to play Hammond B3 and Wurlitzer electric piano. And lo and behold, Andy surprised me. He pulled it off, and now we're a group.
Well, how did the concept of the album come? Because the album itself is kind of like kind of got its 50s, 60s kind of vibe to it. Was this something that was the intention from the beginning, or just kind of what came out of you guys?
Yeah, it was in more abstract terms than that. Andy said to me, "Let's play the music that will remind us of why we got into this whole thing in the first place." And that sounded great to me because, you know, my roots go very deep, and I'm kind of a retro guy anyway. I live in a mid-century house, and I'm a 60s kid, and I love the music from that era, and probably most of my CD collection stops at around 1972. You know, the idea of just playing the music we grew up on and loved and using those influences sounded great to everybody. And that's what we brought to it. And so it was just so comfortable and so enjoyable.
Well, in the song that we heard kind of entering you in, I Don't Want Your Love If You Don't Want Me, that song is your guys' first single. Now, that sounds very much like you guys recorded this live, like all four of you guys are in a studio. I mean, even so much where you can kind of hear you guys yelping in the middle of the song. Is that how it's done?
It's mostly me. What happened was, I was going for sort of a Beatles-y White Album vibe on that song. Mm-hmm. I wrote the chords and the chorus and the melody, and Wally filled in the verses. And when it came time to do the background vocals, I decided I wanted to have sort of like a party atmosphere, like, you know, like Everybody Must Get Stoned or one of those kind of, you know, songs, Rainy Day Woman 12x5, real name of the song. But I wanted it to sound like there was a party with glasses clinking and people going, woo, you know, all that, like there was a party going on. So I just kind of interjected those while we were doing the background vocals just for effect and just to give it kind of a liver vibe, mm-hmm. party vibe.
But so when you guys recorded all the other songs, did you, were you guys all playing together in a room, or was it kind of each person was doing their own part?
No, we were very much all playing together in the room, and then if there were some additional overdubs, like a solo or something, we would overdub that. But the crucial thing was getting the basic tracks all together live in a room. And I'm a firm believer in the fact that, like, the way records are made now with each instrument recorded separately, it kind of in a vacuum, I love the sound of two guitars, bass, and drums blasting away in a room together, and the leakage that comes, you know, that goes into the microphones where the cymbals and the overtones of the chords all mix together and sort of form an atmosphere to the room and create an excitement that you can't duplicate when you're doing it in a vacuum and recording one instrument at a time. So the basics were done with all four of us playing. And like I say, you know, occasional overdubs or solos or something, we overdubbed. But all the excitement, you know, that we could get, that we could capture from capturing those tracks, that's what we did live.
Now, since you recorded this out in New York, I mean, I know that's originally kind of where you're from, but you live out here now.
Yes.
How does that work? Do you basically truck out a ton of guitars and amps? And how do you do that to where you can properly record it and feel like you're getting the sounds you want?
You wouldn't believe it, but, well, I flew to Rochester, New York from L.A., but I took one guitar with me, a Gibson Custom Shop SG Standard, not one of my signature model SGs, not the customs, but a standard, just a cherry red standard with a rosewood board. It just happens to be one of the best guitars that Gibson has ever built me. I don't know why. It's not the prettiest guitar, you know, or anything like that, but that's the way it always goes. Those ones are the best ones. And so I brought my Custom Shop SG Standard left-handed, and I brought a pedal board that was put together for me by Tonetronics in Ohio. And Andy had at the studio a JCM 800 half stack, or two of them, and a twin. And he had for my use a Custom Shop Strat and a Custom Shop Tele and a Martin D18. And so that pretty much covered, outside of, say, 12-string or Nashville strung or something like that, that pretty much covered the meat and potatoes of what you would need to do a rock album.
Interesting. Actually, speaking of the Tonetronics pedal board, I believe there's actually a video on them going through their pedal board that they built for you.
There's a guy out in Ohio named Nick Conti, or as he says, Nick Conti, but it's Tonetronics with an X at the end, and if anybody wants their pedal board sorted out and made sure that all the, you know, everything is feeding the right direction and optimized and in the right chain, he's the guy to work out your pedal board. He's just brilliant at that stuff.
So you were saying you used a JCM 800.
For the most part, I used my SG, my pedal board, and the JCM 800. And for most of the tracks, the key pedal that I used in the pedal board was an Australian-made MI Audio Crunch Box.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that box. I call it my little Marshall in a box. And it's just such a great, harmonically rich pedal. It almost doesn't matter in some ways what amp you're playing through. You can plug it into a twin and it sounds like a Marshall. It's just a great sounding pedal. And I had my Hermita Zen Drive, and I used an MXR Carbon Copy. And we'll get to later I Found You Again pedal steel stuff, because that was a different treatment. But for the most part, my rig was the SG and my pedal board and the Marshall JCM 800.
Now, how did you mic your amp? Do you have a specific way you like to mic your amp?
Well, we had a great producer working with us, Ed Stasium, who's famous for doing the Ramones and Talking Heads and lots of New York bands. And I'd worked with Eddie, God, 30 years ago on Peter Wolf from Jay Giles' first solo album. So I knew Ed for a long time, and the other guys knew Ed too, and Clem knew him from New York. And he kind of took care of the miking and making sure that the sounds were recorded well. To my recollection, I think it was just a simple kind of thing of like an SM57 up on one of the speakers of the 4x12. It wasn't fancy. And I think he had ambient mic set up in the room to pick up the leakage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to get the excitement of the room.
How is recording and this type of an album changed since your days with the Cars?
Well, I mean, we were kind of like looking back a little bit. I mean, the Cars were always on the cutting edge of technology, and you know, the last records that we made were primarily everybody playing their instruments separately on, you know, at different times, and not a lot of sort of live interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a departure from that. This was more like old school, making a record the way, say, like Blind Faith might have made their record, you know?
Right. Well, Jeff, can you play clip number three, please?
Clip number three.
Clip number three.
Elliot found?
Yeah. That one.
Every place, but not in my mind. Oh, so easy to see, yet so hard to find.
Now that clip is from the song "I Found You Again," which
hey, could I possibly get you guys to play the intro of that song, because it really sounds like pedal steel.
Possibly. I will have to have somebody rip it for me. I have the CD.
Oh, you don't have it?
Well, I have the CD, but I just didn't rip the
full
thing. Oh,
I'm sorry. Well, then never mind. So would you like to know how I got those sort of pedal steel sounds?
Yeah, that's that. I'd like to, if you could tell kind of our listeners, you know, what your tricks are doing, or what your tricks are to do that.
Well, I grew up, you know, my first real turn on to country music and really realizing how great it was the Byrds' Sweetheart of the Rodeo album. And also the Flying Burrito Brothers. And so I was exposed to Clarence White and James Burton and Roy Nichols and sort of the Bakersfield side of country as opposed to the Nashville side. I like the California country. And from Clarence and people like Amos Garrett as well, I learned about two-string bends and making a guitar sound like a pedal steel. And so for that track, I fed a Blackguard Tele, like a custom shop Telecaster that Andy had in Lefty, because he does have a music store. I fed that into my Jangle box. Do you guys know what that is?
No, but I think I saw it on your pedal board of things.
Let me tell you what it is. It was designed basically to simulate the electronics that Roger McGuinn uses to create the Byrds 12-string sound.
Oh, okay.
And in the Rickenbacker signature model Roger McGuinn, it has a compressor and a treble boost. And so anyway, the Jangle box is sort of putting all those electronics on a pedal. And so I used the Telecaster through a twin and highly compressed it with a little bit of treble boost, and then used this vocabulary I have of sort of simulating pedal steel licks with funny bends and unusual two-string bends and things like that that you wouldn't normally do in sort of, say, a bluesier idiom. And Andy said, when it started out, Andy said to me, "Do you play pedal steel guitar?" And I said, "No, but check this out." And I plugged the Tele into my pedal board and got the Jangle box going with a little bit of echo. And he goes, "Wow, that sounds just like a pedal steel." You know, I don't want to overstate it or anything like that, but, you know, I did spend some time as a high school kid and learning how to play. I tried to play those pedal steel licks. I was always a fan of Clarence White and Jesse Ed Davis with Taj Mahal and guys, you know, Robbie Robertson and guys that did that sort of Telecaster style of playing. Mm-hmm. So that's in my vocabulary. And so this song that they had was sort of a Stonesy, Empty Flowers, Dead Flowers kind of a tune. And I decided that the pedal steel thing would be a good approach, and I did it. But I just did it on a six-string guitar, and there's no B bender or anything. It's all just fingers.
Wow, that's interesting. How did? What are the intervals that you kind of like stick with? I mean, what do you recommend for our listeners if they were to try to emulate something like this?
Well, it's very hard to explain without visuals. But, you know, for instance, I might get the fifth and the root of a chord, and then on the A and D string, and then on the G string, grab the second and bend it away from me up to the third, so it goes, well, you know, like a pedal steel depressing the pedal. So, the whole idea is to sound like you're stepping on a pedal to move the string. So it's not, it's very different than a blues bend where you add vibrato and you try to make it, you know, as soulful as you can. I was going for very accurate bends.
Now,
if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, did you use any of the behind the nut tricks on this song too?
I might have. I don't remember, but I'm certainly familiar with them. I mean, the thing about playing a Telecaster that I've always said is that, you know, there are certain tricks and certain things that you can do on a Telecaster that you really can't do on any other guitar. And I play a Tele different than I play every other guitar. And so, anyway, my line about a Telecaster, because it's such a basic stick of wood with a couple of pickups, is that you can't tell lies on a Telecaster. You know, you can kind of fudge it on a Les Paul, or it kind of plays itself. It's so easy to play, but a Tele, you have to fight a little bit. And so I always say you can't tell lies on a Telecaster, because what you put in is what you get out.
Well, we've got the beginning of the song loaded up, so let's listen to that real quick.
Check it out.
I've looked every place, but not in my mind. Oh, so easy.
Yeah, that sounds nice. That's really
See,
nice.
There you go. So, and that opening really sounds like a steel guitar. But if you were to listen to, like, The Bird, Sweetheart of the Rodeo, You Ain't Going Nowhere, which is a Bob Dylan song, from the Basement Tapes that the Birds did, you would see exactly where I got that from.
Yeah, I can hear that. That's great. I'm a big fan of that album, too.
I'll always cop to stealing, you know.
But
amateurs copy, professionals steal.
But it's nice how you did those, like, chordal things. That's difficult to do on a Tele without a bender.
Time I spent a lot of time trying to get that kind of style down. And another guy that I really admired was Amos Garrett, who was famous for his two-string bends. Most players will know him from the solo on Midnight at the Oasis, but I was aware of him with the Paul Butterfield Better Days albums and Jeff and Maria Moldauer and Ian and Sylvia Speckled Bird. He'd been around for a while, and not many people knew him. And I think a lot of the reason why people think, or if they tell me that I'm a unique player and I don't sound like everybody else, I think a lot of it is just because I had unusual influences. You know, I was listening to Amos and Clarence White and John Hall way before Orleans, and when he was with Taj. And these guys were sort of playing outside the box. And, you know, a lot of the guitarists of my generation kind of, it began and ended with Beck, Page, and Clapton, you know? And I started out with Bloomfield and moved on to Jesse Ed Davis and Robbie Robertson. I just adored the band, and I loved the economy of playing. And between Robbie and Jesse and George Harrison, I think was a lot of my, and James Burton, I think was a lot of my training of how to play a short solo in a pop song. You know what I mean? Like, to make a really concise and say what you need to say and get out and lead it back into the lead vocal. And it was great training for me to listen to those guys.
Now, I have a question for you. I had walked out of the studio to get the song ripped and put in there, so I don't know if you had answered it. On that song, the I Found You Again, on the pedal steel stuff, what amp did you use?
I think it was a Twin Reverb.
Okay, so it was a Fender.
It was a Fender amp.
Okay.
With my pedal board, with the jangle box and some reverb and a little bit of delay from an analog delay, the MXR carbon copy, which I love.
Mm-hmm. So you have to have delay when you do pedal stuff.
Well, you know, it just gives it some space, and it also kind of stretches the notes out a little bit, so it's less inhibiting. It's less dry and in your face.
Yeah.
And so it kind of makes me relax as a player.
Mm-hmm.
Now I want to kind of kick into talking a little bit about your guitars. Now you probably have, if not the biggest, but one of the biggest collections of left-handed guitars in the world.
I bet I do.
Yeah, there was a picture on your fan Facebook page. It was like 70 guitars, and they were like, yeah, this is just a sample.
It's right around 100. You know, I don't know. I don't count them. I don't measure myself by how many guitars I have. But I play them all. And if there's some that I'm not playing, I usually prune them out of the collection and get rid of them.
Well, that would bring me to my first question. So, you know, you obviously have a large collection. What guitar are you finding yourself playing? You know, maybe a modern guitar and a vintage guitar. Which ones are your two favorites?
Well, my absolute favorite guitar is a 1965 left-handed factory ES-335 with a factory Bigsby without a custom-made plaque. And that guitar is just magic. And I never thought I'd get another one like it. And then the Cars manager, after we did our Cars tour in 2011,
mm-hmm.
gave me an incredible gift. And that was Jeff Kramer. And he gave me a 1965 left-handed Trini Lopez Standard.
Wow.
So, I mean, go find another one of those. So that was, it's kind of like another one of the 335s from 65. So I have like two 1965 ESs, which are just superb guitars. And I love 335s because, you know, of course they'll do the Gibson thing, obviously, but they also twang. And a lot of the early Nashville players played 335s and 355s, like Grady Martin, people like that. And so that's like my number one favorite is my 65 335.
Now, is the neck on that, is it the skinny Gibson neck, or is it works at the nut?
It's what they call an early 65, before they got real skinny at the nut. So the neck is more like a 64, which is like the Clapton one and the one everybody wants.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has a full width. It's not the skinny width at the nut. And I discovered that putting domed thumb wheels under the tunematic bridge allowed the bridge to rock instead of flat wheels to raise and lower the action. They're domed. And so when you press the Bigsby, the bridge rocks a little bit. And it really helps with tuning. And the bridge has the old school nylon bridge pieces and all that good stuff.
Now, what about a modern guitar? What do you find yourself with the modern guitars playing?
Well, I play quite a few. I have my signature model Firebird, which I call the Tiki Bird.
Mm-hmm.
Are you guys aware of that model?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I definitely want to get into that one.
That's a cool guitar, man. You know, I decided, you know, Gibson approached me for a second time to do a signature model. The first one was the white and the Pelham Blue SG Custom 2 pickup.
Yeah.
And so for the Firebird, I wanted to do something pretty cool. And I go on the Les Paul forum and I go on these forums and stuff, and I see people talking about Firebirds, and they're always fighting those mini humbuckers. They're always trying to replace them with something that sounds better. And my experience is that if you get the neck pickup sounding good, then the treble pickup is too bright. Or if you get the treble pickup sounding nice and fat, then the neck pickup is too mushy. So I just decided, the heck with it, I'm just going to put full-size humbuckers in the guitar and make it a regular real guitar, real Gibson guitar. So I put 57 Classics in.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I added four mini switches, which I got Gibson, because the Firebird body is so thin, they couldn't use push-pull pots.
Mm-hmm.
Because the body's too thin to fit those pots. So I had switches done, and I had them get them in white so they would kind of disappear on the pick guard. And there's four switches on there, and one cuts. One is a, you know, a coil tap for the neck pickup. One's a coil tap for the bridge pickup. The next one is in phase, out of phase when both pickups are engaged. And the fourth one is like what we call a blower switch. And that one just flicks to the treble pickup, full volume, bypasses all the wiring, goes right to the jack. So if you're set up for a rhythm sound with out of phase and one pickup or this or that and have a nice sound for the rhythm, and then you want to do a wailing solo, with that fourth switch, you go right to the treble pickup without having to turn off two switches, turn one on, turn this off, and do all that. It's just direct treble pickup full on for screaming solo. And so that was that. I didn't stop there, though. I wanted to get rid of the banjo tuners that are usually on reverse Firebirds for a couple of reasons. One being the quality available on the banjo tuners wasn't what it used to be. And so I discovered the Steinberger gearless tuners.
Yeah, those are high gear ratio too, right?
Yeah, and they're fantastic. And but what they also did, and they're locking, but what they did most of all was remove about 2 pounds from the headstock. So the guitar balances better, and it doesn't have that headstock dive where you let go of the neck and it goes down towards the floor, because I got rid of those banjo tuners. So that was another thing that I added. Finally, I put, I think it's the B3, but I added the Bigsby, Horseshoe Bigsby, the horseshoe-shaped one like Mick Taylor used on his SGs. Mm-hmm. And I added that to the Firebird with the spoiler that Vibramute do. You know, they're the guys that make the Bigsby that you could put on without adding any extra holes.
Yeah, absolutely. I know.
And they have this little thing called a spoiler that, if you know how the Bigsby works, with there's that extra over-under bar where the strings pass under, mm-hmm. and then you got to hook the strings on these pins. Well, this fits onto that, and then you could just slip the strings onto little slots, so you don't have to go through all that nonsense. So I put that spoiler on so it would be easy to string, especially with the locking tuners. And finally, just cosmetically, instead of a Firebird on the pick guard, I had them do a Tiki God, because I like tikis, and I like that lounge Polynesian kind of thing, exotica. And so that was the guitar, and it came in. I chose one of the old 60s Firebird colors from the old Firebird color chart, which was gold polymist. And it's just beautiful guitar. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous, and it's very versatile.
Yeah,
and I've been told by people that it's their favorite Firebird.
Well, I think it's one of the signature models out there that's, you know, it's like, you know, it's not just buying like another Les Paul that has somebody's name on it or whatever. It's actually unique and very cool and usable guitar.
Yeah. I think so too. I put a lot of thought into it.
Now, it also has a unique scale length too, doesn't it? It's like 25 inches, which is odd.
No. The scale is a normal Gibson scale, as far as I know. I haven't measured it lately, but I think it's just 24 3/4, like a normal Firebird. I didn't really have any discussions about the scale length with them.
Okay. Now, on the direct down on the bridge pickup, I'm kind of curious. Was that something that Gibson proposed to you, or is that your own idea?
What, that blower switch?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's something that they've been offering for a little while, for the last couple of years, on their Les Paul standards with the push-pull pots, and one of them is a blower switch. But I discovered it years before when I had a Kramer signature model, and Tom Anderson had done the prototypes for it. And he had three little mini toggles to turn on the pickups, and then he had this blower switch that just went to the treble pickup. And that was the first time I had seen such a thing. And I thought it would be very appropriate for the Firebird, because live, you know, you just don't have time. When you go into a solo from a verse, you just want to flick one switch at the most. You don't want to turn off two, turn on one, and do all this nonsense. So I thought it would be a very useful tool for this particular model guitar.
Now, out of your collection, is the 335 what you would consider one of the most rare guitars you have, or do you have something in there that's just like you would never believe was made in left-handed?
Oh, I have a few of those too. I have a 66 Fender Electric 12 with the hockey stick headstock.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you don't see one of those every day in lefty. And the aforementioned Trini Lopez in lefty, which is wild. I have one of the only Rickenbacker McGuinn limited editions in left-handed. I have a beautiful 66 Jazzmaster, which 66, for those who really know, is the year it had a dot neck but a bound fingerboard. And for some reason, I don't know if they ran out of guitar frets, but a lot of the 66s have jumbo frets, like they use the bass frets because they ran out of frets. Mm-hmm. And so I have a Jazzmaster like that. I also have a couple of the Roger Ross Meisel designed Fender acoustics from the 60s. I have a Malibu and I have a Villager 12 string.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and those are very rare in 12, in lefty, pardon me. Those are very rare in left-hand versions. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got a lot of nice guitars to play.
Yeah.
But those are a few of the rarities.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. Let's go back a little bit. In your work, I've a couple of people when we post.
I should ask.
Go ahead.
I also have a Dan Armstrong clear body lefty.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
that's cool too.
I don't want to forget. That's it. Oh, and I have a 61 or 62, whatever the first year of issue was for Gibson, Barney Kessel custom.
Oh,
so
wow.
The big Barney
lefty
Kessel with the pointy cutaways. And it's in a brown case with the pink inside and PAFs. It's an early...
That's the one with the bow tie inlays, right?
That's the one, yeah, with the big G-clef on the headstock.
Nice.
And I have a factory lefty one of those.
That's really rare. I mean, the customs are rare as it is, but
yeah,
that's really, really rare. But
that's my jazz guitar.
That is cool. Anyway, let me go back a little bit in the past. A couple of people, when we had posted that you were going to be on, had asked this question. What were the main guitars and amps that you used during the cars?
Well, it varied over the years. I used lots of different stuff. I used Marshalls. I used some Boogies. There was a while, well, early on, I used some of the Gibson Lab amps. And because solid state wasn't such a dirty word then, there was an amp called Pierce. Mm-hmm. And I used a Pierce amp for a while. But for the most part, I used Marshalls. And you know, I went through the whole thing that everybody else did. You know, I had a big rack built by Bob Bradshaw with all the components in it, and it was the size of a refrigerator, and I went through all that, but now I'm just back to an amp and pedals, and it just works for me.
Okay, so you're using primary Marshalls now?
Yeah, on the tour I'll be using either 800s, and I also quite like, although they're discontinued, of course, because they sounded so great, the JCM 2000 TSLs. Which I'm a big fan of. I like that triple super lead amp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are nice.
Do you have a preference in speakers when you're using your amps?
I tend to lean towards Marshall cabinets loaded with 70-watt Celestions, so I have a little cleaner headroom. Because, you know, I have pedals for to get the distortion, but I like to get back home to a home base that's clear and twangy for things like I Found You Again. And, you know, when I'm playing like country style licks and stuff like that, I don't want the Marshall to be too dirty. I want it to be snappy and twangy. So I like a Marshall that I can get a good clean sound out of.
Mm-hmm. Very nice.
Yes.
Now I wanted to talk about a few more of your signature guitars, because there's a couple of them. One that's hopefully going to be a signature guitar we'll talk about is your White Tiki. But before we go there, I want to talk about your Martin D28, which is quite unusual. Can you tell us about that and kind of how that came about?
Sure. Well, Dick Boak over at Martin has been a good friend of mine for a long time. And I had an idea for a guitar, and basically I just shared it with him, and he thought it was worthwhile. And so the basic concept behind my guitar is this. I happen to like the combination of Adirondack spruce top and mahogany back and sides. Or just spruce and mahogany. I love hummingbirds. I like J45s. I like D18s. And those are some of my favorite acoustics. I think they're very sweet-sounding guitars. But I always felt that Martin gave short shrift to the 18 series guitars. You know, they had dark binding and, tortoiseshell binding and very unadorned, very simple, less dots on the fingerboard and, and not ivoroid on the binding and stuff like that, and a very simple rosette around the sound hole. So what I wanted to do was design a guitar with the beautiful looks of a D28, only with mahogany back and sides. So what we did was Dick told me they had some quilted mahogany, which sounded beautiful. And so we used the quilted mahogany with an Adirondack top and herringbone and all the pre-war D28 cosmetic features. And then he suggested going with a tortoiseshell rosette around the sound hole, which is what they do on the Clapton signature model. And that sounded pretty snappy to me. So I said, let's do that. And it's got gold Waverleys and, the forward shifted bracing and the scallop bracing and all that stuff. So it's basically a D18 dressed up like a D28 because I just love the sound of mahogany.
Yeah, it's a beautiful guitar. I mean, when I saw it, I was like looking at it and I'm like, oh man, that is so nice.
Well, I always just thought, D18s are such fabulous guitars, but they're a little bit plain Jane. So I didn't want to go all the way with like a 42 or something like that. I thought it would be appropriate to make a mahogany based guitar, but with the 28 style appointments.
Yeah. Well, and with an Adirondack top, you can't go wrong. I mean,
no, you can't. It's all about the top anyway.
It really is. Like, to be honest, like I have a D28 that I just bought that has Adirondack top, and I compared it to a guitar that has Brazilian rosewood over at a local shop here. And the Brazilian rosewood was an $8,000 guitar. Mine was quite a bit less.
Yep.
And then mine killed it, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, I read a story about Torres, or one of the famous, or maybe Ramirez, one of the very famous Spanish guitar makers. And for an experiment, he built a classical guitar with, I guess they used cedar or spruce for the top, and he built the back out of paper mache. And the guitar sounded every bit as good as his guitars that had Brazilian rosewood back and sides.
Wow.
So I came to the conclusion that the soundboard was really the money deal there. You know, that's really where a lot of the tone came from. But I do love mahogany. I think I don't know if it's right between rosewood and maple or anything like that, but I find that it's very sweet and it's very even and records well. And where like rosewood is almost like a grand piano where there's rumble to it, where engineers a lot of times EQ some of that low end out, the mahogany seems to have its own balance where you don't really have to pull any low end frequencies. It just sounds good.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I have a mahogany guitar, and I love it. It's like a Canon.
Yeah. I grew up with loving hummingbirds, seeing Keith Richards and playing hummingbirds and Beggar's Banquet and all that stuff. I love those sounds, you know. And I discovered that Clarence White played a D18 for his lead stuff and played his big sound hole D28 for his rhythm stuff. So I know he liked D18s too, and yeah, I just it just took some kind of strength to realize that the most expensive is not necessarily the best. And so to go for, I have a D28 made out of Indian rosewood.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two HD28Vs, the vintage styles. And one is made out of East Indian rosewood and one is made out of Madagascar rosewood. And they both have Adirondack tops. And I'll give you one guess as to which sounds better, which is my favorite. It's the East Indian rosewood. And as beautiful and chocolatey as the Madagascar looks, I'm sold on the East Indian and, of course, above that, the mahogany, good-sounding mahogany.
Well, in your guys' new video you guys released, which people can find the link on your Facebook site, for I Don't Want Your Love,
yes.
You guys give a huge love towards Gretsch guitars. And you have a very interesting kind of White Penguin sort of esque guitar. Can you tell us about that guitar?
Yeah, I can tell you about that guitar. It basically was an outgrowth of my signature model Gretsch that I had during the 90s, which was a duo jet that I had made a few modifications on. That guitar had the 25-inch scale that you referred to earlier, because I wanted to get a bit more twang out of it. And I took the bridge, and the way most Gretsch duo jets where the bridge is sitting on a wooden base, I got rid of that, and I put the Tune-O-Matic on studs. And I put the Bigsby B7 with the underbar so that the strings would be pulled down tight against the bridge, and there'd be a lot of break angle, so that's where your sustain is. And I took a lead from Brian Setzer and put the locking spursels on. And so that was a great guitar, and had TV Jones pickups. And that was a great duo jet. I kind of was trying to design a duo jet that would go toe-to-toe with a Les Paul and get rid of some of the kludgy elements of a Gretsch guitar and make it really roadworthy. And so the White Tiki was just an attempt to make sort of a really deluxe version of that. It incorporates all those features that I described to you just now, except it has the Grover Imperials, the Art Deco Imperials. But all the other stuff, the bridge, the Bigsby, the scale length, and all that stuff was taken from my signature model duo jet. And while I was at Gretsch, I thought maybe we can do a super deluxe model of the duo jet. But I didn't like the name White Penguin. I thought, what the hell is a penguin got to do with rock and roll, you know? Unless you're Mick Fleetwood, you know. But it just didn't seem like a really rock and roll image. And I love that tiki exotica thing. And so we made it the White Tiki. And there's a, you know, a little plate at the headstock says Elliot Easton Gretsch White Tiki, and there's a tiki on the pickguard. Essentially, it's my signature duo jet dressed up like a penguin but with a tiki.
And it's wired unusually, correct?
Well, yeah, somebody told you about that, huh? Yeah. You know, I always felt like a Gretsch guitar, to really look like a Gretsch guitar, has got to have a lot of knobs and switches on it, because that's just part of the charm of a Gretsch guitar. But I didn't necessarily want to fuss with all of that. So I had Gretsch put all the knobs and switches on, but they're not connected. There's no wires leading to them inside. All that I'm using is a master volume and a toggle switch for the pickup selector. And so the tone switch, which some people call the mud switch, and the individual volumes for the at the bottom of the guitar that would control the pickup volume, those are all disconnected. And I just wanted, you know, full strength, you know, Filtertron. And that's got TV Jones in it. So yeah, it looks from, you know, on site like a regular equipped Gretsch. And it could be wired that way if I wanted to rewire it. But it's wired real simple, almost like a Telecaster, just a toggle switch and a master volume.
I feel like you should be pulling jokes on people when you're on tour with that guitar and have them play it and then be like, you broke my guitar.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe so.
So, well, do you think Gretsch will be releasing that, you think, as a signature model?
Well, I don't know. You know, I really don't know yet. If I do a Gretsch model, it'll be something a little bit different than Tiki, in that I will probably try to make a guitar that gives a little bit more of a Les Paul tone, but looks like the Gretsch, but has all the charm and the glamour of a Gretsch. And so I'm not quite done tweaking that thing. And if Gretsch give me the opportunity, then I will share my observations with them. But in the meantime, I mean, like for this tour, I'm taking the SG that I used for the album, and I'm taking an RO, a Gibson RO reissue 1960 that's all cherry. It's like a sweet cherry. So it's got a flame top of all red. And it's got Lindy Fralin pickups and RS Guitar Works pots and oil and paper caps. And, you know, I kind of tweak my guitars as best I can to put the good stuff in. And that's what I'll be using for this tour.
Well, we're coming to the end of the show. I have one quick last question for you.
Yes.
So as a kid, I always wondered, well, not totally wondered, but I always, you know, the Cars videos always stood out from everybody. Like, for instance, the song, you know, you might think, that video, that music video, what? Who came up with the ideas for your guys' music videos? They were so much different than everybody else's.
Well, usually the directors came up with it, and that was like a groundbreaking video because it was the beginning of sort of, you know, computer animation. And there was an application, I guess, or utility that these people used called the Paintbox. Mm-hmm. And it was a company called Charlex, and they had the Paintbox. And that was how they put, like, Rick's head on a fly's body, you know, have Rick climbing up the side of the Empire State Building and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But every director would come to us with, you know, he'd have listened to the song and come up with sort of a concept of how to, you know, interpret the song visually. And for the most part, we kind of went along with it, you know, and we had some great directors doing it, you know.
Well, I have to say, I'm glad that you guys did, because that's one of the videos as a child, you know, that totally sticks out for me. I mean, that
well,
one...
that won the first VMM, what is it, VMAs. I've got my little spaceman, and that was the video of the year, 1984 and 1985, first year MTV had the awards, and that You Might Think video won.
Well, it deserved it for sure, because it's definitely one of the two or three videos for my you know, younger years that I remember and really enjoyed as a kid watching.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. It was a lot of fun to do.
Yes. Well, again, we want to thank you so much for coming on the show. And for all of our listeners, make sure you check out the new album, The Empty Hearts.
Please.
And you can pick it up at multiple places. But, you know, as I mentioned, Amazon, iTunes, all those different places.
Yeah, and look for us coming to your area. I mean, we plan on touring a lot and hitting all the towns we can. And so, you know, people have said, are you coming here? Are you coming there? We're just getting started. So hopefully we'll be coming to your neighborhood before too soon.
Well, thank you so much, Elliot. Hang out on the line. We're going to leave with the song 90 Miles an Hour on a Dead End Street. And we want to thank Sweetwater and thank Elliot again, once again. Thanks
a lot. Everybody have a great week. We'll see you next week. Hang on.
Thanks, everybody. Nice talking.